all of the European science community that had tested genetic engineered alfalfa had clearly seen objective data beyond a shadow of a doubt that if you grew and treated and harvested genetic engineered alfalfa exactly according to the label and then fed that to dairy cows and milked the milk and put it under a microscope, there was five times the amount of glyphosate in that milk that would cause a pregnant woman or a pregnant cow to abort.
You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Gervais.
Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gervais. I am a certified holistic nutritionist and the host of the show. At Food Integrity Now, we like to investigate and explore what's happening in our food supply so that you can make wise decisions for your health and for your family's health. And I'd like to give a big shout out to Ben Sound Music for our intro and outro music. My guest today is Pat Trass. Pat is a fourth-generation rancher and making a name for himself as a father, rancher, and activist. He is a member of the farm and funded group Dakota Rural Action. He has been working to keep genetically engineered Roundup Ready alfalfa from threatening the livelihood of conventional and organic farming. Hi, it's Carol Gervais, and I am a certified holistic nutritionist, a life coach, and the host of Food Integrity Now. What you eat and how you eat can greatly affect the way you look and feel and whether or not you get sick. If your immune system is compromised, you might have brain fog, allergies, low energy, depression, have trouble sleeping, you might be overweight, perhaps you get frequent colds, or worse, have a disease. A poor diet can lead to diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, heart disease, obesity, and virtually all other diseases. I take great pride in working with individuals and groups and seeing how they create such positive changes in their lives. I offer one-on-one coaching packages, or we can design a package just for your group. To find out more, go to foodintegritycoaching.com or call me at 415-302-7100 for your free consultation. I offer phone and Skype sessions, and this really is all about quality of life. Let me assist you to have the best quality ever. Hi, it's Carol again. Do you drink almond milk? Do you know that packaged almond milk contains all sort of nasty additives like carrageenan and barely contains any actual almonds? The good news is that you can make fresh almond milk at home in minutes. Once you taste the creamy, fresh flavor of homemade almond milk, you'll never go back. I make my almond milk at home with a Nutiana nut milk bag. It's great, easy to use, easy to clean, and makes my almond milk silky smooth. Buy yours today by searching the Nutiana nut milk bag on Amazon. That's Nutiana, nut milk bag. Or go to Nutiana.com. You're going to love this bag. Pat, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Hi, Carol. Thank you for inviting me to this interview.
Well, you are more than welcome. We really want to hear your story. Before we get started with all the GE alfalfa issues, can you tell us a little bit more about you and how you got involved in ranching and maybe a little bit about your ranches?
I am many, many generations. My great-great-great-great-grandfather came. He was a trained soldier from the British Isles, its Welsh background, to Massachusetts in 1644, defended the colonial villages, and he shared that real estate with the first college in North America, which is Harvard. And so his name is in that building's administration. His nephew and the nephew's friend, Jim Bridger, are contracted to provide the security for the settlers that were moving and settling the western states. And then subsequent descendant of those first Trasks was in the Civil War defending the Union. And when he and his fellow soldiers were dismissed in Iowa in 1775, they were dismissed in Iowa and they traveled to Fort Pierre at the Missouri River, crossed the Missouri River in the dark of night and set foot for the Black Hills, where the gold had been found on the expedition to explore the Western Plains states. So they were going there, having been discharged from the Civil War effort. And so that was in the spring of 1875. And so my family has been in the Black Hills and on the plains ever since then, ranching. That granddad was Al Trask, and his son was Mac Trask, who was the lead cowboy for C.K. Howard, who was the founder or co-founder of Sioux Falls, and had a ranch, which is the ranch that we're on. And so my granddad worked for him for years and then was the first owner after the Homestead Act was ratified of the Two Rivers Ranch, where the Belfouche and Cheyenne Rivers come together. And alfalfa seed, when it was first brought to North America, my granddad Mac Trask was one of the first ones to plant it and irrigate it out of the Cheyenne River at the confluence of the Belle and the Cheyenne. And the Trask family and the adjoining neighbors have been growing alfalfa seed in western South Dakota ever since then.
Okay, and how many acres do you have there?
We operate on about 12,000 acres of deeded land, and then we lease, and then my sons have additional acres that they own and lease in the area. And so we usually harvest between 2,500 and 4,000 acres of alfalfa a year for hay, and then seed as often as it is naturally available.
Okay, and South Dakota is sort of the parent state of alfalfa in the U.S. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of alfalfa and why you feel maintaining the genetics of the alfalfa is so important?
Yeah, the older public varieties that I first remember hearing of were the ones that came into the same latitude, longitude in North America as it had been being grown in Europe. And so the land-grant universities, like our own South Dakota State University, were instrumental in doing what land-grants were formed to do, and that was disseminating for the affirmation and mobilization of the state's agricultural producers those varieties of this new legume. And so COSAC and Grimm, and then later Vernal and Ladak and a bunch of those other public varieties were the early ones that were planted and, you know, irrigated and sub-irrigated. And we still do the irrigation out of the Cheyenne River on our fields that can be irrigated, but there are so many areas in western Dakotas that are sub-irrigated where the underground aquifers are close to the surface, and that's where a lot of the stands are 5 to 55 or 60 years old and extremely winter hardy and very prolific in both hay and seed production. And so those are the basis for the alfalfa perennial plant kingdom worldwide, because They've already withstood the grasshoppers and the drought and the intensely harsh winters like the one we're just coming out of. And so for a long time, the seed that was grown in western South Dakota, predominantly western South Dakota, is the nucleus and the biggest vendor of American alfalfa seed that gets exported to the other countries of the world because it's not grown under contract here like the proprietary varieties seek to do in the mountain states where the irrigation cultivation of it is predominant. Western South Dakota, it's just mostly grown as a cross-pollinated variety not stated, and it is a accumulation of all the varieties, public and proprietary. And so these are tried and true, essentially forthcoming from the early public releases that our land grant system made available.
Okay, so let's talk about genetically engineered alfalfa, which is why I really wanted to have you on the show today, and how your concerns have prompted you to become so involved in lawsuits and other resolutions to try to stop some of this genetically engineered alfalfa. Can you walk us through a timeline of this? It's my understanding that genetically engineered alfalfa was approved in 2005. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And at that time, there maybe was a small percentage of genetically engineered alfalfa, but I think that percentage has gone up.
That would probably be from the information that I am just getting from sources that are leadership sources in Canada and America, the recent conclaves that took place maybe in Las Vegas, and some of our colleagues in Canada who have been arm in arm with us producers in the U.S. to resist this looming potential contamination by the holders of the international patent rights of biotech patents on alfalfa. They were needing, the Canadian Growers Association was needing to have us help them surface the information for their growers in order to substantially resist what was being offered. The number is more correctly, the maximum that was ever reached was 15% acres of GE alfalfa, and that is probably mostly the contract acres of producing the seed. There's in the states where there's way more precipitation than western South Dakota, there was quite a bit of looky-loo messing around with it, but those areas don't produce seed because they have too much humidity and too much precip. And so the decline is happening now from the peak of the Roundup Ready or biotech alfalfa, that the sales are declining pretty rapidly because it is not proven to be what it was advertised to be. And we knew that from testimony that surfaced in the spring of 06 in the capital of Pierre, South Dakota, because the Secretary of Ag was moving to try to stave off the biotech alfalfa from entering the ecosystem of South Dakota and potentially contaminating our seed industry that is a bulwark of the economy here. And so the testimony, and I was there and gave testimony, came from the leader of the company that held the patent rights, and he was dismissed from the microphone for perjuring the science of the information that he took an oath to present only the truth. And there were two certified organic growers that were amongst the legislators, and they caught him on that. And then the Secretary of Ag dismissed him. He attempted to tell them that genetic engineered alfalfa was superior to the conventional alfalfa varieties, and that's not true. And the biggest reason why it is not in all considerations superior is because any plant, whether it's annual or perennial, that is genetically engineered to resist the chemical glyphosate, which is the active ingredient of Roundup, the side effect of that is that it's higher in fiber. And that means automatically fiber and the nutrient content, the TDN and the protein, are inversely correlated. So if a plant's higher in fiber, it's lower in protein and total digestible nutrients. And that's an automatic effect, the side effect of engineering the DNA to resist the chemical glyphosate. So what they were doing was patenting a plant so that they became the monster monopoly over the vending of perennial alfalfa, but it was not a superior plant. It was only brandished to be, and that representative of that company was caught in that deception by the testimony of two of South Dakota State University's scientists, and they gave testimony in exact opposition. And so those things are now proven by the producers, because there's not what was advertised to be the cost-benefit ratio. Number one, the seed costs several times more than the conventional varieties. But and Mr. Geertsen, who was in the suit with us, and I put an advertisement in every bag of seed, of any kind of seed, there's a certain legal tolerance of weed seeds that can be admissible in that per pound offering of the seed. So in a 50-pound bag of alfalfa seed, that amount is about a heaping tablespoonful. Every one of those bags has that amount of weed seed legally admissible in that bag, and every one of those seeds is already there because it is already resistant to glyphosate. So the growers, whether it's an annual seed or a perennial seed, are planting resistant weeds in their fields when they buy that genetic engineered patented seed. And now they're all seeing that everywhere. Why are we having these resistant weeds? Well, when you bought that seed, you bought the resistant weed seed that had already passed through being treated by these chemicals.
Oh, okay. So what you're essentially saying is that by doing that, it has created super weeds.
It has. It has, and it has spread them exponentially throughout the United States or any country that dabbled with this false god of biotechnology. And so the patenting of perennial genetic engineered alfalfa wasn't to improve the plant that's always been referred to as the queen of forages. It was to pursue monopoly. It was monopoly mania. That whole monopoly mania was what we had been trying to resist by expanding our sales areas, and that's how we met Mr. Geertsen. We were taking seed to New York and Pennsylvania in horse trailers of cleaned and bagged seed that was grown on our property and the neighbor's property, and selling it to the farmers in the eastern seaboard states that had been paying way more for alfalfa seed than what the growers here are being paid for the real stuff fresh from the farm. And that's how we got acquainted with Mr. Geertsen. And then Mr. Geertsen made us aware of the USDA legalizing this patent right and giving the deregulation status. And so then we began immediately to try to mobilize the elected officials locally to prevent the presence of that in a contaminating way into the production vicinity of western South Dakota. And that's why we have no contract acres here in western South Dakota. And the areas that were contracted early on, even before the garnering of the deregulation decision, those areas are heavily contaminated, and that's why the holders of the patent rights are trying to get Canadian growers to be more willing to contract produce conventional alfalfa, because the conventional growers are contaminated in the mountain valleys of of the other western states where proprietary contracts are prevalent.
Can you talk a little bit about that contamination? That because I know that's one of the major concerns.
But perennial plant reproduction is vastly different from annual plant reproduction. And so early on, the people who were trying to garner the patent rights of perennial plants to be genetically engineered were predatorizing the lack of understanding about the difference between perennials and annuals. And so when they presented the data to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the question has to be presented in the data about gene flow and potential contamination, they presented the data that was only a small part of the picture of gene flow. It was predominantly that it's 900 to 1,500 feet per year that the pollen will travel laterally into other areas of conventional fields. But they held the real data that was produced at the University of California, Davis, that it's more than 2.5 miles per year because hot winds and other pollinator insects than just cutter bees are involved in the whole pollinating reproduction system of perennial legume plants. And so when that real information was presented to the federal court in California, the judge immediately recoiled from that as a horrible prospect and issued the vacator and then subsequently the injunction that stopped it temporarily from going forward because the loss was going to be severe in the litigation, which Secretary Vilsack in 2011 reiterated in that press conference, that contamination and the loss of those markets is a serious blow to all of the production sector and of the national economy.
You had two federal lawsuits in San Francisco?
Mr. Geertsen and I were parties. We were the standing parties of the lawsuit that was challenging the wrongfulness and the illegality of the deregulation decision that was a violation of the NEPA law. In other words, there hadn't been the formidable environmental impact study and statement that was necessary in order for that to be a coherent legal decision. And we challenged that. The lower court upheld our position. The appeals court upheld it. The next appeals court upheld it. The Supreme Court upheld it 8-0. And so the subsequent action that re-legalized it was when the congressional leadership of Frank Lucas calling a special session to tell Vilsack, either you re-legalize it or we're going to go around you by congressional statute. And that's why it became legalized. Again, Vilsack said, we don't have any choice. We know it's going to mean a loss of conventional alfalfa. It's going to mean the loss of our export markets from those contaminated areas, and it's going to mean the beginning of litigation between farmers and companies and countries. But he said three times at this point, we have no choice.
And what year was that?
That was in 2011, right after the midterm election. Mr. Lucas was reelected because of the campaign donations by those big corporate entities that were seeking this monopolistic mania.
Yeah.
And so he was reelected, even though a lot of incumbent Republicans were defeated. And the Kiplinger Washington letter aptly prophesied that he would catapult right into the chairmanship of the House Ag Committee, and he did. And the first objective that he undertook was to press Vilsack to re-legalize genetic engineered alfalfa. And subsequently, that was in early January that he called that special session. In late January of 2011, Vilsack re-legalized it when he said, we have no choice.
Wow. So where are we now with?
Well, right now, the consumers and the producers are pushing back because the information is slowly surfacing in spite of the stranglehold on ag journalism that those corporate monopoly entities have mustered for a long time. the information is surfacing between farmers and in the organic and all natural circles of both production and consumption, that these things are a big problem. The superweeds are a big problem. The effect of glyphosate on the soil and on the plants and right. on the gut metabolism of the mammalian cattle, hog, sheep, human beings, it's a detrimental effect, and that information is surfacing by the diligent and even self-sacrificial witness, testimony, and research by scientists, by medical and health professionals, and by activism amongst the organic patriots of our nation and of other nations.
Yeah, I think our listeners really understand the effects of glyphosate, not only on the environment, but on human health. We've done many shows about this, and this is a real problem because the animals that consume the alfalfa becomes part of them, and then we eat them, and it's getting harder and harder to avoid.
Well, you know, way back, before we were in the Supreme Court, we were in the federal system working our way up through, and we had already garnered the vacator, which meant that it was not legal to plant it or to sell it. Mr. Geertsen and I and all of the people that were pursuing truth and passionate about defending it were aware that all of the European science community that had tested genetic engineered alfalfa had clearly seen objective data beyond a shadow of a doubt that if you grew and treated and harvested genetic engineered alfalfa exactly according to the label and then fed that to dairy cows and milked the milk and put it under a microscope, there was five times the amount of glyphosate in that milk that would cause a pregnant woman or a pregnant cow to abort.
Wow.
And so it is, as it is passing through into the digestive tract of a mammalian creature, the alfalfa is moving through with the glyphosate in an amount that is massively an abortifacient. And as it is moving through the vaccine system, and that's already been seen,
right.
when chickens were first fed the GMO corn, it was coming through as an altered protein, and our vaccines are containing the egg whites as the carrier of most of our vaccines. Those proteins were causing all kinds of toxic reaction amongst the people that have been having immunizations like flu shots every year. And so it's a serious health menace.
Yeah, it really is. What are you doing now to work on getting rid of the genetically engineered alfalfa? I mean, is the prognosis good, or what are your thoughts about that?
I spend quite a bit of time and effort all through the year when I know of some producer that was a looky-loo and bought some seed. They're buying seed in these rare instances because they don't really know what the downside of it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll call them and go over that because I do know all of the specific and scientific and economic reality of what's going to happen as the dominoes tip for them. Why don't you get out of this as quick as you can, destroy that stand before there's any chance of a plant avoiding the sickle bar and blooming and cross-pollinating? Just get rid of it. A lot of the early fields that were planted in the U.S. because of this catastrophic decline in alfalfa acres during the whole ethanol revolution from 94 forward, there was more than 32 million acres of net reduction of forage acres, and that included a lot of the alfalfa acres in the U.S. And so a whole bunch of the earliest plantings of genetic engineered alfalfa for for forage production, not for seed production, got taken out because, number one, it's just not as nutritious as conventional alfalfa. Number two, it was illegal for a while, so it's kind of a risky Russian roulette deal. Let's get rid of that and get it into wheat or corn or soybeans. And so a lot of those early acres got eliminated just because of the transition from forage to grain. But the later ones, we're trying to bring them up to speed so they don't become unwittingly victimized by what Secretary Vilsack was calling the inevitable litigation if and when contamination occurs. And that's the beatitude of not having any contract production where it's legal for somebody to let it bloom and pollinate. We don't have that in South Dakota. So we are a premier environment for preserving conventional alfalfa.
Well, that's some good news.
Very good.
Yeah, that's wonderful news. I'm concerned, and I think we as consumers need to be concerned, and the best way that we're going to be able to stop this, I think, is through people taking some action and through education and educating people, because I run across people all the time that still don't know what a GMO is or have never heard of glyphosate.
If everyone starts transmitting their curious energy to informed energy, and their informed energy to concerned energy, and their concerned energy to activism, always in the presence of charity and openness to truth, all of these looming dangers will pass away, because that's human history, that's be speckled with grace. Wherever evil occurs, grace occurs thereby to a greater degree. And so we have to keep transmitting those energies to the functional part of dispensing with the threats and the evils, and humanity keeps rising toward its ultimate destination.
Yeah, well, that was very well put. Thank you, Pat, for being a guest on our show today and for all the work that you've done. And, you know, you've done some amazing work, and you've gotten what you've accomplished in South Dakota is a testament to what you were just speaking about, of taking action, and the truth will prevail.
And all of us producers cannot tell you how grateful we are for you patriotic journalists who put yourself on the line for making truth more known. Thank you, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. It's very important to me. And the more I learn about GMOs and glyphosate, you know, people ask me, what direction are you going to go with Food Integrity Now? And I say, I'm just going to keep educating about it, because not enough people know yet, but we're working on it. So thanks again, Pat, for being with us today and for all the great work you're doing. And thank you to our listeners, and have a great day, and take some action today. Look up something about glyphosate. Maybe you can learn something and tell somebody that doesn't know. And as always, be well.